Welcome. You are listening to Copland. Copland is about the life and times of our protectors and defenders, police, fire, EMS, medical trauma units, and the military. The underappreciated doing the unthinkable for the often ungrateful. I am Jay Dobbins, and I'll be your host. In each season, we will hear three episodes featuring extraordinary heroes, amazing personal experiences that will inspire and uplift you. Sometimes they might shock you. The highs and lows, the successes and the failures, told in their own words and all experienced during their personal journey of sacrifice to make the world a safer place. This is Copland.
The bomb went off just as hundreds of people had showed up for work, just as children had been dropped off at a daycare center on the second floor. In one devastating moment, the whole front side of the building was ripped away. There is simply no way to be specific about how many people have lost their lives. But the death toll is clearly increasing as the hours go by and emergency teams work their way through the devastation.
On April 19, 1995, America experienced the most devastating act of domestic violence in our history. A bomb was detonated at the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Its force was generated behind 5,000 pounds of high explosives, and it set off seismographs 15 miles away with a Richter scale reading equal to a 3.0 earthquake. The event introduced a new term to our vocabulary, homegrown terrorism. Hundreds of people were injured by the collapsing building. Others were sliced deep by shattered glass that took the form of razor-edge shrapnel, leading the explosion's shockwave. 168 people were killed. 19 were babies in the building's daycare center. This is the final chapter of Copland Season 1, Blood and Bone. Episode 3 is titled, Send Me. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8 reads, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And I said, Here I am. Send me. We are going to meet Oklahoma City firefighter Chris Fields. Chris spent 31 years living the epitome of the send me mantra.
I always remember it was a Wednesday, and we shift changes at 7 o'clock in the morning. We work 24-hour shifts, so in all up until my retirement, 31 years, if I wasn't there by 6 a.m., they knew I was late. So I got there at 6 a.m. that morning, drinking coffee, exchanging information with the guys. The other shift went home. We were going about our daily routine for a Wednesday. And around 9 a.m. Was when we were standing around the kitchen table, and we felt the station, it felt like something hit the station. The station shook, the windows rattled. Went outside and couldn't see anything. We looked back to the south to downtown Oklahoma City and saw a large plume of black smoke. We were 14 blocks away, so we knew we would be dispatched. So we at that time at my station, there was a engine, a rescue ladder, and a hazardous materials unit. And I was the officer on the hazardous materials unit that day. And we just self-dispatched ourselves down to the scene.
Chris's recollection of that morning is forever etched in his memory as surreal.
When you replay it in your head, I see like a scene from a movie, how they would play it in a movie. I mean, we're 13, 14 blocks away from the site, and we're going through what's kind of a business district somewhat, but all these storefront windows are blown out. And I remember reporting that on the radio that we were, 12 or 13 blocks away and seeing store front windows blown out, people coming out with dazed looks, probably how we looked when we came out of the fire station. And we got to Northwest 5th Street, and that's the street that the Murrah Building sat on. And making our way to the Murrah Building. A lot of walking wounded from flying debris. Shards of glass and metal from some of the cars, I think, that exploded. And so we set a triage up right there.
Chris's first rescue that day was a victim, alive, but trapped and unable to free herself. Fire and police working together to save innocent lives.
15, 20 minutes into that is when one of the chiefs called my hazardous materials unit down to the scene to help the Oklahoma City Police Department get a lady out of the basement. She was stuck in the basement. She wasn't, like, entrapped by debris or rubble. She was tangled up in, like, a suspension ceiling wire, those acoustic ceilings, and we helped free her.
As Chris moved forward into the chaos, he encountered a baby.
A gentleman approached me and said he had a critical infant. And I just, you know, and still to this day, I mean, I see it now, but, you know, I always wondered why, but my mom said, she's always told me there was a reason it was you, and I just said, here, I'll take her. And he handed me Bailey Almond, and first thing I did was check her for any signs of life, you know. I had to clean some, she had a lot of, I want to say insulation, but I think it was just like dust in her throat, so I had to clear her airway out. She had a slight open skull fracture, and I, you know, lifted, put my head down there to see if I could hear or see her breathing, see any chest rise, didn't see any signs of life. So I walked her across the street to an ambulance was parked over there. Same thing Sergeant Avery said. I said, hey, I have a critical infant here. And told him that, you know, I said, I can't find any signs of life. I know paramedics and ambulance have these little Doppler deals where they can get kind of even a deeper pulse if there is one. So the ambulance was full. They had somebody on a stretcher. They had somebody on the floor. They had somebody up on a bench seat. And there was two or three people on backboards outside the ambulance. And the ambulance, the paramedic told me, he said, you know, hold on, we're going to get a blanket. He said, we're not going to lay that baby on the ground. And, you know, looking back now, that's when the photo was taken.
Chris continued on, seeking more opportunities to rescue others trapped in the wreckage.
You know, after that, we went back into the building. I caught up with my crew. They were working to free another lady named Sheila Driver. And I remember her name specifically because I was an officer on the rig, and so when you're on, like, a medical call, the officer gets all the patient information. So they were actually talking to her, sounding out where she was. They were asking her, where do you feel the pressure? You know, and she would say, I feel you on my lower back. Now I feel you on my butt. Well, we knew we were going away from the head. And that's where we wanted to start at the head, but we wanted to know where she was at so we'd be more careful. And they dug her out, and while they were getting her out, she was telling me, Sheila Driver, she was 28 years old, she was pregnant, and we got her on the backboard, and they had to set up a rigging system because we were so deep down in there, and they set up a rigging system on a bunch of ground ladders. And they hoisted her out and took her to the hospital. That was the last, you know, live person we had contact with that day. The rest of the day was... For us, I know there was other rescues around the building, but for us, the rest of the day was spent pretty much in recovery mode. Just they brought in search dogs, and the search dogs would go around and find a scent. I think they had live scent dogs and cadaver dogs, if I remember correctly, or if I'm understanding what they said they had. And these dogs would hit on a scent, and we would kind of look where the scent was, and a lot of times we could see people that are already deceased. We could see parts of their body.
Our brave firemen accept incredible personal risks on our behalf. They ignore the threat to themselves as they move into the danger, in this case, continuing to search for victims in a bombed-out 8-story building teetering on the verge of collapse.
Just kind of the structure of the building, how the stability, it was up to us and structural engineers that had come in with the USAR teams, urban search and rescue teams, to say whether... Yeah, we can go ahead and remove this victim, or let's mark it. We're going to have to stabilize this part of the building before we can move any debris. They had set up laser deals on the building to where if the building moved the smallest increment, they would evacuate the building, stabilize wherever their movement is, and then say, okay, you can go back in. But, you know, for the first 5 or 6 hours, it was just, you know, digging, moving stuff, and not even thinking about, you know, the structural stability of the building.
What our first responders see and experience can never be unseen or unexperienced.
To take people out, put them in body bags, and then you know, put 12 on the body bag or 13 or put a number on the body bag. And then it was really weird to know that, okay, victim 12 was missing a hand. Well, 3 hours later, you come across a hand, whether it be a white female or black male or whatever, and you have to go back and say, hey, you know, we found the hand that goes with, you know, this one.
If you don't recognize Chris Field's name, you'll recognize his picture. It went viral, and he became the iconic representative of all first responders when he was photographed with the recovered body of one-year-old Bailey Allman from the bombing's rubble. Chris talks about that moment. Bailey limp in his arms, looking down on her, mostly helpless to do anything beyond treating her with gentleness and dignity.
We went back to station 11 o'clock that night, and that was the first time I learned that there was a photo taken. We got a call from the dispatch office, and a guy named Harvey Weathers, he was chief, a good friend of mine, he said, hey, Chris, did you carry a baby out of the building? I said, no, Harvey, I didn't. I said, of course, I didn't know he was a policeman. I said, a gentleman handed me a baby. I said, let me ask the other two officers, because there was three of us that had red helmets with five on our helmet. So I asked them, and they both said, no, they didn't. So I told Harvey, I said, Harvey, I guess it's me. And the reason he couldn't identify it real well, it was faxed to him. So it was kind of grainy. He said, he could tell it was a red helmet with a five. And he said, I can tell it's you, Chris. I can see your mustache. You're looking down. And I said, okay, Harvey, why do you need to know? And he said, well, the AP is called here and they want to identify the firefighter in the photo. And Chief Mars at the time said, you know, certainly, that's just public knowledge, you know. So said, certainly, if you can identify him. Well, he said, it's you, Chris. And I said, okay. He said, well, the guy on the phone says whoever's in that photo, it's going worldwide tomorrow. The next morning, the other shift came in to relieve us, and in the Daily Oklahoman, our paper there in Oklahoma City, it was an inset picture on the front page. Then I think some guy come in and put down the USA Today, and I think it was on the cover, and then somebody else brought in something else, and then we turned the TV on to watch the news coverage, and they were showing all these, how it was the story around the world, and showing all these newspapers that were going out all over the world, and it didn't matter what language it was in, that photo was on the cover of it, and that's when it really, really kind of hit home.
Chris reflects on how the day-to-day carnage he witnesses affects the lives of its victims.
And looking back, and that's how I know when the photo was taken, is when I was waiting for that paramedic to get the blanket out. And I specifically remember looking down at her and just thinking, because she was, I found out later, she was a year old the day before. Well, I had a 2-year-old son at home, so I knew she was pretty young. And I was just thinking in my mind that, wow, somebody's world is going to be turned upside down today. And like I say, and then not realizing that scene of, or that thought of death was going to be portrayed 168 times around the building that day, you know. Mine got caught on film. But there was other, you know, firefighters, paramedics, police that, you know, did exactly what I did and the other guys did. It was just one of them deals. And so I think that was, and then seeing the photo in the paper, on TV, again, my first thought was, oh my God, that family. I didn't know if they'd identified, you know, her, knew her, the outcome or anything. So that was one of the things that I thought, oh my God, these people are going to, you know, mother's instinct, she's probably going to recognize that's her baby just by seeing her, you know, because you really couldn't see Bailey's face. But I think they knew.
Chris developed a strong bond with Bailey's mom, Erin. Credit goes to Erin Allman for her support of Chris in the telling of this story and the role that she and Bailey played in it.
Bailey's mom, Erin Allman, she was a 20-year-old single mom at the time on April 19th. She requested to meet us. I had a reporter call me on Friday. The bombing was on Wednesday. And I got back Thursday, the very next day. A local reporter called and said, hey, Chris, you know, I knew, it was, her name was Cynthia Gunn. I knew her. And she said, would you want to meet the mother of Bailey? And by that time, through news stories, we'd heard that, you know, Erin had already identified Bailey. And all that. And I said, no, Cynthia, I really don't. I mean, that was just my reaction. I said, I don't think I could. And she goes, well, okay. We were talking to her, and she said that she really wanted to meet you and Sergeant Avery. I said, oh, well, that changes everything. I said, if she wants to meet us and or meet me, I don't know about Sergeant Avery. I said, yeah, I'll be there. So we went and met her that Thursday evening, you know, a little over 24 hours after the bombing. And, you know, the first thing she did was thank me and Sergeant Avery for handling Beatty like we did. She said I could tell she was taken care of. She was loved. She wasn't handled just, you know, thrown to the side or, you know, or whatever, that she was actually cared for. And she said she can tell by looking at the picture that I was a father. She said I could just tell. And, you know, and from that day on, it's just kind of been like a big brother, little sister kind of deal. Talked to her just, you know, just the other day. She's been married and had two kids since then. And she's been to our graduation parties for our sons. And we've been to her birthday parties and graduation parties for her kids. Went and had April 19th of 2019 was 24 years from the bombing, but it was Bailey's 25th birthday on the 18th. So we met and had a drink and, you know, to celebrate Bailey and all that. So it's just been a friendship with her family, her parents, her sisters, everything. And they're just like a part of our family, just like an extended part of our family.
Chris is transparent about the damaging side effects he suffered behind his involvement in the Murrah bombing, how his guilt was triggered, and the impact it had on him and his family.
In my mind, I battled with a lot of guilt for being singled out. You know, it's just not what we do, firefighters. It's kind of a team effort thing, and being singled out. And, you know, a lot of times reporters use the words hero and stuff, and we all shy away from it. And you don't like being singled out. I struggle with a lot of guilt over the photo being published like it was, and what Aaron had to go through. It's probably a guilt I shouldn't have carried. I mean, it wasn't nothing my fault, but it was just I didn't know how to deal with it. So I felt guilty for that. I felt guilty for, you know, being the last one to hold her child. That weighed pretty heavy on me. But I just kind of suppressed it down and pushed, you know, and went to work. And for the next 5 or 6 years, and to jump ahead is when I got a trigger, which, and then I didn't know what a trigger was then, but we were putting a pool in the backyard, and I was helping the guys bust out some concrete on the patio, and it started to rain. And a lot of people don't know, the early evening of the bombing, it rained. Just enough to stir up that concrete dust and that wet concrete dust smell. Well, it started raining while I was busting concrete in the backyard, and I got a little smell of wet concrete dust. And I was like, wow, I said, that smells just, to my mind, to myself, I said, that smells just like the bombing. You know, I didn't have any big major reaction, didn't, other than the fact that it just really stuck with me. And looking back now, when I can replay it and be honest about it, I noticed over the next 6 months to a year, I started having little bouts of thinking about the bombing a little more often, a little more anger about it. You know, the negative things that a few people did say really started to eat at me. I became very irritable with my family, which it, when I'm going through it, I'm denying it, you know, but my wife sees it every day, and she's telling me, and I don't want to hear it. But now when I go to work, I'm a different cat. You know, when I go to work, I'm happy-go-lucky, follow me, boys. I ain't going to get, you know, I can do this job, and, you know, Mr. Personality, and, you know, nobody rubs me wrong. I can get along with everybody, but let me come back home and I'm right back to in my shell and irritable and defensive. And, it led to a pretty bad home life. And I always preface by saying that, you know, I don't blame any of this on any kind of PTSD or anything. They were conscious decisions that I made, you know, to be an idiot. And, but it was just at a time when there is so much going on, and that I don't consider the repercussions. I don't care about the repercussions. So It led to an extramarital affair. It led to me and my wife being separated for a year, year and a half. But that was probably the start of, I guess, my rebuilding or my something I had probably needed for the last 20 or 25 years. But that was the start of it. No matter how bad it got for me personally, living in this apartment by myself, running up bills that nobody wants to pay because I wanted to be the good guy. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, but I wanted to be, which was being an ass, but I wanted to be the good guy too. I wanted to keep that public persona up of the good guy. So, you know, I told my 17-year-old son, yep, you're the man of the house now, you know. Told my, 11-year-old son at the time, hey, let's do what your brother says, help take care of your mom, 11 years old. But I wanted to be the good guy, so what do? At that time, I was dead set. I was trying to get my wife to divorce me. I mean, I was saying stuff and doing stuff that, that way I'm not the double bad guy. I didn't file for divorce, but I kept, paying the house payment, paying my apartment rent, paying all the phone bills, paying the car, and I'm not saying it for sympathy. I'm saying that was me doing it on purpose, running up credit cards just to pay bills so everything would look like I'm happy. It's exactly how I wanted things to go. See guys or girls and they, hey, how you doing? Oh, man, great. Never been better. On my own, do what I want, Nobody checking on me. But that was just a persona I, carried on for a year, year and a half until had a pretty eventful night. I always say this, but I look back and I think I never was suicidal. But when I look back and I'm going, I used to mix my Xanax and Crown Royal to a limit to where, I didn't know whether I was going to wake up or not. So, I could probably say I was. I didn't think of a way, but I would find that maybe on a house fire or go a little deeper into the house fire than we should. That way if something happened or, a car wreck where a car's unstable, maybe getting in positions where I normally wouldn't get, or if somebody else did it, I would, chew their ass out for it.
Chris learned that from the ashes, he was able to find his life's purpose.
So that went on for a while. And then I had woke up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and was looking for my family in this little apartment I was living in and just sweating, looking for my family, couldn't find them. Started having trouble breathing, I just hit the floor and just kind of, I just remember thinking at that time that there is no way this is my purpose, is to die living alone in an apartment, number one, feeling sorry for myself, blaming everybody else but myself. And the next day is when I talked to my wife, Cheryl, and told her I wanted to come home. And her first words were, come on. But, we got work to do, but we can do it. And that's when the healing process for me really started.
Chris talks about his wife, Cheryl, her amazing willingness to forgive, and how she rescued him.
She just always, I remember she would always tell me, this isn't you. This isn't you. And she'd look at me and say, where are you? And she'd tap me on the head, knocking on my head, where are you? Are you in there? She just knew it wasn't me.
The totality of a life spent serving others and his involvement in such a catastrophic event as the Oklahoma City bombing opened a door for Chris to understand that some of the struggles he was facing dated back to his childhood.
A lot of people think the PTSD I was diagnosed with and all that, was from the bombing, from the photo, from the bombing. And I'll say, that was a catalyst for me getting a lot of help for a lot of unprocessed trauma that I dealt with throughout my life and through the years. And, there's a lot of, there's a lot of things. There was, being molested when I was 10 years old, something that never, ever had been told to anybody until that point. And that was a lot of stuff that I battled with that a lot on the fire department, because you're sitting at the station and a news story comes on about a child, being molested or something. about that age, 9, 10, and typical firefighters, you know, you're 10 years old. You don't sit there and take that. You do whatever, and you run, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm almost sweating talking about it now. I remember that feeling going, even driving home more, that it was my fault, that I knew what was right and wrong. I should have, you know. And so that was something I really struggled with. And like I say, the counseling, once I broke that shell, even, it opened up a lot of unprocessed trauma for a lot of things with some brothers that, you know, died in the line of duty on the job, that we, as firefighters, law enforcement, we're all big, tough guys and girls. And we, you know, we lose a brother or sister in line of duty or whatever, and we go to their funerals, there's tears, and we hug. We don't ever talk about it and process it. And I've heard there's a big difference in talking about something and processing it, you know, and actually going through the steps of the grieving and all that. So that was just a long road of several years of counseling and going to treatment for PTSD. You know, and some guys deal with it. Girls deal with it different. Trauma's different for everybody.
In 1987, an 18-month-old baby named Jessica McClure was trapped after falling 22 feet into an 8-inch-wide water well in Midland, Texas. The world watched on live television for 56 hours as rescuers raced to save her. Midland Fire Department paramedic Robert O'Donnell was a key figure in baby Jessica's rescue. Like Chris, he received an extensive amount of fame and recognition for his extraordinary heroism. The side effects of that publicity took a massive toll on O'Donnell. He began to suffer the emotional consequences of the attention on his rescue, and after seeing the reports of Chris's actions in Oklahoma City, O'Donnell received his own trigger that resulted in tragedy.
They dug down or drilled down, and I guess he was skinny enough that they picked him. He was a paramedic. The story goes they just covered him in KY jelly and slid him down this encased hole. And he used the tripod of a photographer that was on the scene to reach down far enough and grab hold of her and pulled her out. Great story. Successful rescue. From all accounts, baby Jessica went on, you know, live out her life and a great life. And but to where I look at it and go, man, what a great positive story. You know, for him, this is where it really hits home to me that trauma is so different for everybody, that we think, well, what a great event. It all came out good. This guy, 4 days after the Oklahoma City bombing, he ended up losing his job in Midland, Texas, under the suspicion that he was on abusing prescription meds. That's what he was accused of. Lost his job. Marriage ended. And 4 days after the Oklahoma City bombing, he went into the ex-fire chief's office and put the picture of me and Bailey, and then he pointed at the picture of me and Bailey, and he said, this guy right here has no idea what he's getting ready to go through. He left that chief's office, drove across his family's ranch, and wrote a note out to his two boys, I think they were 10 and 12, and said, sorry to check out this way, boys, but life sucks, and put a shotgun to his head and blew his brains out. And that really drove home to me to where something we think was such a glorious, great ending of a successful rescue, what can be traumatic about it, you know? Well, just going through the process, you know, and then the limelight, and then maybe he struggled when the limelight went away. I don't know all the stories. But the photograph of him was actually him coming up out of the hole, holding her. And that was what was like on People magazine and on a lot of newspapers around the United States. One of the things we dealt with was that was when he did shoot himself, people thought it was me, because everybody said the fireman holding the baby in the red hat. Well, look at the photo. He's wearing a red ball cap. But everybody just said the firefighter holding the baby in the red hat blew his brains out. So there's like people calling my wife at work saying they heard I'd blown my brains out.
As a lawman, my fears were always of being shot or stabbed, or as an undercover operative, being captured and tortured. I would prefer any of those circumstances to fire. Natural instincts cause most of us to run away from fire. Chris talks about the unique character trait of firemen to run into it.
Firefighters, and I say we're all, I identify as a firefighter, not a first responder. I mean, we're in that first responder family. Firefighters, and I love people, they're a different breed. I think it's a calling. It definitely is. I think anything that we do, you know, even in your job, the dangers, there has to be a calling or something in your heart, or I just don't think you can do the job. Or the ones that don't, they usually burn out, to me, before the ones that do it for the love of the job. You know, there's what I can name 1,000 occupations where I could make a lot more money, you know, and so you got to be doing it for the love of the job. That firefighting, there's just that personality that we're it's just that helper personality. I felt like maybe that's why I got so involved with Aaron after the bombing, as far as being like a big brother. I felt like I needed a protector. That's just that protector mode, or that protector's heart. And I think that's the calling of the job. And then, number one, I mean, we train pretty well. So I don't know how y'all relate it in law enforcement. I don't know what gives you that adrenaline rush, but the thought of fighting a house fire was I don't know. I can't explain it. It's just a huge adrenaline rush. But I think it's the reward, and it's not monetarily. It's just that reward of knowing that you got in there and did your job. And I guess you say firefighters really live on, we pride ourselves on making a bad situation better. That's what I love about the job. There is no, you know, we go on whether it's a full arrest or a car wreck or a house fire. You know, we don't check their race, we don't check their religion, their ethnicity, we don't check their income. We don't care. We're there to take a bad situation, their worst day, and make it better. Other than that, I can't think of a situation where, you know, that any firefighter wouldn't put themselves in. We go to the gates of hell to protect people we don't even know. You know, we're willing to lay down our lives and die. Guys have done it in the line of duty to try to protect somebody.
Chris talks about the role of faith and God in his life as a firefighter.
Faith and God has always been a part of my family. That's how I was raised. My mom is what I label a prayer warrior. That's just a great title for a prayer warrior. I mean, that's how I was raised in the church. So it's always been a part, you know, and mom, especially like when the photo, we found out about the photo, you know, and, you know, there was a reason, you know, Christopher, that's what she always called me, you know, there's a reason that it was you. But in my mind, inside, I'm going, he needs to reveal the reason pretty quick because it's eating me up, you know. I got angry, and that's when, I think that's when things really, when I started doing things what I wanted to do and didn't follow what I felt maybe there was a path because it wasn't happening quick enough. I think I threw away a good 6 or 7 years being angry, cussing God, saying, you know, why would you, you know, put me, you know, through this? And that was another thing I learned. I kept saying me, me, me. Well, having no idea, probably having an idea, but not really wanting to acknowledge it, what I was putting my family through. I mean, just, it's horrible. Once I hit what was rock bottom for me, and God and prayer was a huge part of me and Cheryl getting where we are today. And I always say, that's two things if I hadn't learned anything else, I learned that mom's always right, and everything is on God's timing, period. No matter how mad we want to slow it down or speed it up, if we try to do it on our timing is when things usually don't work out.
I asked Chris to talk about his greatest achievement and his greatest regret. His response was emotional, and his answer was the same to both questions.
My greatest achievement is probably, and I'll get emotional talking about it, it's probably my family. The fact that I still have my family. Growing up, I think any kid, you know, their dad's their hero, especially when they're law enforcement or a firefighter. But I really think that my sons probably have more respect and admiration for me for what I went through and where I'm at now than the actual job I did. So that's probably my greatest achievement. Biggest regret is my family and what I did to my family. I've been forgiven by God. I've been forgiven by my family. But I live every day still trying to forgive myself. And because you can never take it back. I said some things and did some things that, yeah, she's forgiven me and things are great. But I just still, sometimes I was like, golly, what was I thinking, you know? And so I think in both instances, my family. And I think it's the things I did to them and put them through. But on the other hand, it's also my greatest achievement, the fact that I'm where I'm at today with my family.
Chris is on a mission to inspire those who are struggling, encouraging others to lower their guard, and by using his own life story as an example, he helps people to reach out for help and to talk about the issues troubling their lives.
It's breaking that stigma of reaching out. And I always like to say, reaching out doesn't mean you're going to a counselor. Doesn't mean you're going to be diagnosed with PTSD. Doesn't mean any of that. Reaching out is having a buddy that you can talk to. I was of the ilk that I didn't like taking it home to my wife and tell my wife about my day. If you've got that relationship, go for it. But talk about it. Don't let something fester up, you know, like a blister and just get worse. But don't wait till you've almost lost your family or have lost your family or tried to take your life.
Chris demonstrates the love and passion for his profession that we see in so many of our heroes in the fire services. Those men and women are truly extraordinary in courage and exemplify the send me mindset like very few can ever imagine. Chris is in high demand as a public speaker, where he offers his story as a message of hope, not just to first responders, but to any of us who need some real life inspiration. Chris can be found on Instagram and Twitter at FF4OU. That's the letters F as in Frank, the number 4, O as in Oklahoma, and U as in uniform. He's a Boomer Sooner fan, so think firefighter for Oklahoma University. Look Chris up on his website at www.chrisfields.org. Copland is produced for those courageous men and women whose alarm clock goes off every day. They put their feet on the ground, buckle on gear, and kiss their families goodbye with no guarantee they will ever come home. They go willingly, facing predators and violence on behalf of good and innocent people who simply want to live safe, peaceful lives. Thank you for listening. God bless and go be amazing.